So, thank you. I'm going to give two short talks instead of one. And I promise to try and finish on time. And the reason I'm giving two is both are in response to popular demand. First of all, lots of people have asked me what's going on with this, what's the story at the moment with multi-graviton scattering, with three-graviton scattering in particular in the matrix model. And so I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about that. I'm not going to give a detailed review, partly because I don't understand well enough what's going on at the moment, and I hope people have also asked me, well, will something be written someday? And certainly if I understand in a concise way what's going on, I will probably, you know, at least put something on the web explaining my understanding. And the other, though, I thought perhaps in light of the situation, I thought perhaps at first I should drop this other talk I was going to give, but with Lenny so bitterly complaining last night that there's no phenomenology at this meeting, I thought I should give at least the one at least brief phenomenology talk here. So let me talk, I'd like to say first a few words about multi-graviton scattering in the matrix model. And as I said, this is not a review, but just a status report. And just first of all, to remind you, last fall, Arvind Rajaraman and I claimed that there was a discrepancy between the discrete light cone quantization of supergravity, or matrix models, in the process in which three gravitons went to three gravitons. And complicated explanations were offered by us and by others to reconcile this result with the arguments of Sen and Zeidberg. And in fact, I should say there were two aspects to this calculation that we did. First, there was a matrix model computation of the S matrix. Okay, and to do that, we use various simplifications which occur in the limit that the three gravitons are separated by distances r here and little r, where r is much greater than little r. Okay, and there are various simplifications that occur there and make it very easy to extract certain terms in the effective action. And it's also easy to then compare this to, and then from that we need, having computed the effective action, in the matrix model, we then needed to compute the S matrix, and this, as I'll explain, is a delicate step and perhaps the source of the problems which have arisen. Okay, and as I'll say a little more about that. Okay, and then the second part of this program was to compare with the supergravity S matrix, so we just calculated, sort of using conventional Feynman diagram techniques, the supergravity S matrix, in this limit, things appeared very simple. Okay, now, many people made various criticisms of aspects of this work, and I just listed a few of them here. And most recently, and I think compellingly, Washington Taylor, student Ramzunk, noted that as Q goes to zero, as the momentum transfer, the smallest momentum transfer in the problem goes to zero, the graviton, the graviton furthest away, if you like, should couple to the integrated stress tensor. And they pointed out that this being the generator of translations in X minus, it's quantized and shouldn't be corrected. And this seemed to contradict aspects of our supergravity calculation. Okay, so we got quite worried by that. And then as we were worrying, we received a paper, which I think is decisive, by Yonea and Okada, which contains a complete and beautiful computation of the effective action, both on the matrix model side and on the supergravity side, and where they find complete agreement. And just, you know, so this is the paper. I think it deserves more than just having its preprint number shown. Okay, and if you've looked at this, it has a very, very elaborate and beautiful computation. And I just want to point those who have been following this story to the relevant equation, which is equation 252, okay, where they actually write down the supergravity estimate, the supergravity effective action. So what they've done here, in a manner quite similar to that used by Polchinski, and Katharina and Melanie Becker and Arkadiev Seitlin, they've written down an effective action essentially for these things thought of as particles, as d particles, if you like. Okay, and there's a first term here which is essentially the term on the supergravity side, which was found by Arvind and myself, and then there's a second term. And this term, if you when looked at carefully, cancels the problematic term. Okay, so those of you who I say want to go and try and track down try and track down what's happening here, that's the first place to look. Okay, so where... So I think this is almost certainly correct, and in that case, we can ask where was our error. My guess is that this was in this problem of extracting the S matrix on the matrix model side. As I said, the effective action on the matrix model side agrees with the results found by the found by Yonea and Okada, and in fact, you can check various other terms very easily. Okay, and I believe there's a concise description of this, which is in progress. Let me just say a word or two more about this, again, just for those who have been following. Oops, except I'm getting my pages out of order here. Okay, so the problem, if you like, is connected with graphs like this. On the supergravity side, you can think of sort of some kind of covariant Feynman diagram, okay, which has which has a sort of singular propagator, something if k is the momentum here and q is some momentum transfer. This is k dot q plus q squared. Where does that arise in the matrix model? Well, one way to think of that about that is to think about this famous v to the fourth interaction, v to the fourth over r7, as a sort of effective Hamiltonian, working to second order in perturbation theory in that Hamiltonian. This factor arises as an energy denominator. Okay. And in fact, the most singular piece of this diagram is easily seen to be the same on both sides. Okay, there's something that involves p to the fourth and this energy denominator on each side. Okay, but if you now look at subleading terms, you have to worry here about operator ordering. Okay, so what do you mean by this p to the fourth? Does it act on the initial state or the intermediate state here? And depending what you assume about that, you can get almost any answer you like. In fact, you can almost cancel this energy denominator, giving rise to precisely this extra term. Okay, now, Arvind and I were aware of this, and it was the fact of this almost that made us believe that, in fact, that this was not the origin of the problem, but I now strongly suspect that it is. So that's really all I'm going to say about that, except to quote a famous rap star who told me more than once, don't mess with matrix theory. Okay, so as I say, I hope, obviously, as you can imagine, I'm worrying about this a lot, and I hope to be able, and I'm happy, I should say, to discuss privately with anyone. I already have a great deal with anyone who would like to discuss any aspect of this, and as I say, I hope to be able to provide some kind of concise description of what the story is at some time soon. Okay, so now I want to turn to, as I say, to this brief phenomenology talk, okay, and I'm going to have to explain what I mean by all these things and what we're after here. Okay, this is work with Yossi Neir and Yael Shadny. Okay, lost it. Okay, so I want to talk about first just a little bit about moduli and string theory, or M theory altogether. And moduli, in fact, I think we've sort of developed a point of view over the last few years that moduli are really something very wonderful, because they are certainly a useful tool to studying all sorts of theoretical issues in string theory and in supersymmetric field theories. Okay, but of course, from the perspective of string theory as a theory of nature, they raise many puzzles. Okay, for example, any dynamics, okay, which selects the ground state of selects some sort of ground state of string theory is almost inevitably strongly coupled. Okay, so, and this means strongly coupled in a rather strong sense, not just strongly coupled in the sort of sense we've been using in discussions of duality, but strongly coupled in the sense that there better not be, almost certainly can't be any sort of weak coupling description of the ground state. Okay, and I should say that alternative possibilities have been offered, and I'm not really going to, I don't really have any argument against them, okay, and I just mentioned some of these, and there was supposed to be a talk here, which I referred to, which is, I guess, not happening, so, but in any case, there are, but sort of the most simple-minded picture of what's going on suggests that that the problem of finding the string ground state is truly a strong coupling problem. Now, moduli also raise problems for cosmology, okay, a point that was stressed by some time ago by Banks, Kaplan, and Nelson. If we imagine that somehow some dynamics pick some random point in the moduli space as the vacuum, so it's sort of somewhere here, or maybe somewhere out here, or someplace else, there's no particular reason that in the early universe we should start out at that point. Okay, so this is a point without any particular symmetries, perhaps, and you know the some modulus is 1.768 M Planck. Why do we start there? And as you know, if you make that assumption, if you just assume that that you start out some sort of Planckian type distance in field space away from the ground state, okay, that what you find as you let the universe evolve is that you have too much energy stored in this field. This field sloshes around in here for a long time. Okay, and you have too much energy stored in this field, and this leads sort of generally to various catastrophic consequences. Now, one rather simple solution to this problem is the possibility that all the moduli, okay, that this point, whatever it is really a symmetric point, by which I mean that all the moduli are charged under symmetry, some kind of symmetry in the true vacuum. And I use the word charge rather loosely. I don't necessarily mean that I have a gauge symmetry. Okay, these may just be discrete symmetries, for example, under which the moduli transform. But if it were true that all the moduli in the true vacuum, okay, were transformed under one symmetry or another, okay, then this point would be special, and it would be quite natural for the universe to start out at such a point. Okay, so for example, finite temperature effects typically favor points of high symmetry. If you think about writing some kind of effective action for the theory for these fields in the early universe, it's quite natural. It's technically natural, if you like, to start out or to have its minimum at that point. So inflation, for example, might leave you at this point, and this problem goes away. I mean, the real point is just that if there is a symmetry, then this point, if you like, has a sort of flag, okay, and says, here I am, okay, and it's quite reasonable to start out there. Okay. Still, another possibility, of course, is that there just aren't moduli at all, okay, that there are no relatively light fields of this sort, okay, and that, of course, would be a resolution to all these problems. Now, I forgot to mention, I should say, one, when I was talking here, what's really the issue, okay, what's the issue back coming back here to this question of, suppose that, you know, we just start sitting at some random kind of strongly coupled point, well, then there are lots of puzzles, okay, so again, this is the phenomenology talk, so we know in the world that the gauge couplings, and I mean here the gauge couplings we observe are weak, and they seem to be unified if we assume that there's some supersymmetry. Okay? And from this perspective, this is a very strange accident. Okay? Why should the couplings be weak? Why should they be unified at all? Okay? And as I say, this racetrack scenario was one scenario offered to possibly explain that possibility, and another Tom Banks and I called Kähler stabilization, the idea that somehow complicated corrections to the Kähler potential are responsible for stabilizing the various moduli. And I go up and down about whether I view that as an appealing prospect, but I know that when Ed mentioned it last year at a conference, he looked unhappy. Okay, so I'm sorry. I made my little speech about cosmology. Okay, let me say a little more then about the possibility that all the moduli transform under one symmetry or another. Okay, and I'm going to refer to these points as points of maximal symmetry. Okay, and I should say that I think the title of our paper caused some confusion. I think that, you know, a lot of us are very proud now that we can produce models with, you know, enormous rank and all sorts of things. And I didn't really mean maximal in the sense of producing a big number. I mean maximal in this more limited sense. But anyway, such points have another virtue, apart from solving this problem of cosmology, and apart from being very symmetric, and that sort of maybe sounds nice, that's that they're automatically stationary points of the effective action, whatever the effective action may be, and whatever we may even mean by that if we're not quite sure what we mean. Okay? And so they're candidate minimo, candidate ground states. Okay? And we might hope to study some aspects of them using dualities. Now, let me first of all give you an example, a kind of trivial example, with various unappealing features. In fact, Vadim, in a discussion of this, referred to it as, among other things, as just boring. But just the simplest example I know of this phenomenon is to consider toroidal compactification of the heterotic string and take the torus to be a product of circles, each at its SU2 point. Okay? And in that case, all the moduli are charged, you can check, are charged under the various SU2s except the dilatant. Okay? So there's only one multiplet, if you like, or one modulus is uncharged. But you also know that this theory, we also know now that this theory has an SL2Z symmetry. Okay? And at the self-dual point, okay, the analog of the self-dual point for R to 1 over R, this S transforms. Now, this symmetry at this point is presumably just a discrete symmetry, but still, S transforms under it. Okay, it's a real symmetry. Okay, and so it's an example of this phenomenon I'm speaking of. Okay, this is not a wonderful example. Of course, it has N equals 4 supersymmetry. This isn't really a phenomenology talk exactly. It has N equals 4 supersymmetry. Alpha is equal to a half. Okay, because this is electric magnetic duality. Okay, so it's not that appealing in a lot of ways. But you might imagine that this phenomenon, given the things we know, is rather common. Now, I'm not really in a position at the moment, and there are probably people here who are, to say how common such phenomenon are. Okay, I'm certainly trying to study this in simple examples. But it's plausible that such phenomena occur, okay, rather frequently. Okay. So suppose we assume that the ground state of string theory, which I should say, I just mean the state, whatever it is, which describes that what we see, okay, is such a point of maximal symmetry. Well, there are still lots of questions you can ask. For example, why is there weak coupling and why is there unification? That's still a question. In our simple example, we had a very strong coupling. Okay. Well, there are various answers you might give to this. One is that you might say these are still accidents, but I sort of think that they're more plausible accidents. Okay, the couplings, for example, the gauge couplings, will be, in such a theory, some pure numbers, perhaps determined, since this is a state of high symmetry, by some simple considerations, like some sorts of topological considerations, or topological field theory arguments, or what have you. Okay, and if there are many such points, well, perhaps among some of them, okay, the couplings are large and unified. Okay, the question of whether you can actually, or what circumstances you can actually compute such couplings and so on is an interesting question in itself. It's a question that, for example, Cutrue and Silverstein have looked at a little bit in other contexts. Okay? But one could still imagine this is true, and this is sort of what we're going to assume in what follows. Okay? Another possibility is that, similar to this Kähler potential stabilization I talked about, that the Kähler potential somehow plays an important role here. The Kähler potentials are responsible for, the singularities rather in the Kähler potential are responsible for restoring symmetries. And in such a case, one doesn't have simple general arguments that the couplings tend to be large. Okay? And there's a toy example again in this paper, which I referred to, which I won't go through. Okay. So what I'd like to do then, for the last couple of minutes of this talk, is to adopt a set of hypotheses and explore their consequences. Okay. So what are the hypotheses? Well, I'm going to assume that at some high scale m, which for the most part take to be the Planck mass, but doesn't have to be, one has a theory with A, this sort of maximal symmetry, or alternatively, no moduli at all. Okay. I'm going to assume that it has approximate n equals 1 supersymmetry. And I'm going to assume it has small unified gauge coupling. And I'm going to ask whether these simple assumptions have consequences. Okay. So let me first of all imagine that there are no moduli. Okay. Okay. And in that case, I claim that supersymmetry breaking in such a theory has to be a phenomenon of the low-energy theory. I should say, by the way, I should back up and say that these this hypothesis, you can, you know, you're welcome to criticize any one of them. Okay, there are, you know, it could be that we understanding of hierarchies and so on doesn't require n equals 1 supersymmetry. Okay, it could be that the smallness of the that the couplings aren't even small or unified at some high scale. Okay, but these are plausible assumptions. They're sort of assumptions that a lot of us have worked with for a long time. Okay, and so within that, I want to explore what happens. Okay, so. Well, first of all, I claim that supersymmetry has to be a phenomenon observable in the low-energy theory. It has to be something you can see in the low-energy field theory. Why? Well, what do I mean when I speak of high-energy string effects? People often talk about maybe high-energy string effects are responsible for supersymmetry breaking. Well, operationally, what that means is that if we somehow integrate out the high-scale dynamics, that we find, say, a superpotential for some field phi, okay, which is responsible for supersymmetry breaking. Now, what that really means is we have to find a linear term in the superpotential for some singlet field. Okay. But, well, in this theory, we don't have any moduli, so the moduli aren't the candidates. And I don't think it's that plausible that there are other light singlet fields around at strong coupling. Okay. Okay. So I should attach the usual caveat in string theory, that here I'm applying a sort of notion of naturalness, okay, which we don't know should hold. Which I would argue plausibly may not, probably does hold a strong coupling, but we don't know this, and we know examples of string phenomena which don't obey conventional ideas of naturalness. Okay. That means, but as I say, this fact that there is no such term means supersymmetry is visible in the low energy dynamics. Okay, for example, there might be some kind of strongly gauge theory, gauge sector, some hidden sector, okay, some set of fields. Okay, which would break supersymmetry. Okay. And then we could ask, what's the scale of this breaking? Well, again, if there are no singlets, okay, one can't break supersymmetry at a high scale as in sort of conventional supergravity models. This is something that's been discussed off and on for a long time. I think most precisely in this paper I mentioned earlier. Okay. And in particular, the problem is that if there are no singlets, you can't generate masses for ordinary gigginos. So the gluinos and so on have to be very light. Okay. And as a result, what you find is what you can argue is that supersymmetry breaking has to be a relatively low energy phenomenon, a phenomenon of sort of TeV type scales rather than much higher scales. Okay. And presumably associated with something like gauge mediation. Okay. 5 minutes? 3 minutes? Thank you. Okay. If I keep going the wrong way in these things, I'm not going to be too fast. Anyway. Well, what about this idea of maximal symmetry? Okay, well, again, I claim supersymmetry breaking. I claim the story is basically the same, but supersymmetry breaking has to be a low-energy phenomenon. Why? Well, because all linear terms in the superpotential are still forbidden. Now they're forbidden by the symmetries. Okay, so I can't write the phi as a modulus, I can't have W equals phi. Okay. I can't have the sort of conventional Gugino condensation for the same sorts of reasons. Gugino condensation is sort of driven by couplings like phi W alpha squared. Okay. And again, those couplings have to vanish at the minimum. Okay. So again, supersymmetry breaking, okay, has to be something that occurs at low energies, okay, via some hidden sector, perhaps involving gauge mediation and so on. Okay, now, I said that one of the nice things about such a picture is that maximal symmetry points are automatically stationary points of the action. I can ask really in more detail in such a picture, how would the moduli be fixed? And there are a few possibilities we can imagine, and I'm going to mention what I find is the most attractive even first, and that's that we can imagine that all the moduli are in fact charged under standard model gauge symmetries. Okay. Now, this is not completely crazy. When the minimal supersymmetric standard model, for example, has approximate flat directions in which all the gauge symmetries are broken, and I've indicated one here. This particular set, in fact, has 12 parameters, or 12 candidate moduli. Okay. And, for example, you could ask, well, okay, but this is a statement about non-renormalizable couplings, but in fact, you can ensure an exact flatness even by symmetries rather than such as discrete R symmetries, Okay, that doesn't necessarily, exact flatness doesn't even require stringy kinds of miracles. Okay, so these could be our moduli. Okay, and then how would the moduli be stabilized? Well, if we imagine there's some hidden sector which breaks supersymmetry, and say there's gauge mediation, well, what does gauge mediation do? It generates masses for the squarks and sleptons through some loop graphs with alphas and lambda and so on. Okay, and in general, of course, by construction, one insists that those models should have positive masses for these scalars. Okay, and that precisely means that there's a local minimum at the symmetric point. Okay, so in this picture, the moduli could be just partners of the fields we see, okay, and the mechanisms which give them mass could be the mechanisms which stabilize them. Okay? Now, of course, it could well be that, as suggested by our earlier examples, that some of the moduli are neutral under the gauge symmetries, and then there are all sorts of couplings which can give them mass. They tend then to be very light, okay, masses, say, of order EV or so. Okay? But they also tend to be extremely weakly coupled to ordinary matter. For example, a conventional Brown-Zwicky coupling is forbidden, again, by symmetries, and Yukawas and so on are also tend to be suppressed. Okay? And finally, they could be the moduli could be some participants in hidden sector dynamics, and for example, the models of Intrilegator and Thomas, where there are singlet fields and classical flat directions, could be examples of that sort of phenomenon. So let me just end then, okay, with a few, some conclusions and some questions and some puzzles. Okay, well, one obvious question, as always, is the cosmological constant, and I have no particular wisdom to offer on this other than to say that that one can in such a scheme or in such a picture imagine generating a constant in the superpotential of the correct order of magnitude to give vanishing cosmological constant, but of course I don't know whether that's the right question. Okay, we have seen this kind of picture predicts low energy supersymmetry breaking and gauge mediation. So these are sort of generic consequences, I think, of this hypothesis that we've made here. Okay. And this suggests a sort of approach to phenomenology which does not perhaps require very complete control of string dynamics. It requires enumerating models, perhaps enumerating possible gauge symmetries, ideally perhaps being able to calculate gauge couplings at high scales. Okay, but you can imagine all sorts of things which are more limited, require more limited knowledge than solving some very complicated dynamics. Okay, and I'd like to end, so in some sense, this last item is a question. Okay, is there a sensible program here that one could carry out? Okay, and then finally, one other question is, are there other consequences of this viewpoint? Okay, so I've listed one, which is this sort of picture of low energy supersymmetry breaking. Okay, but are there others? My suspicion is that there aren't other generic consequences, okay, but certainly within any specific models or specific approach, okay, there certainly will be other consequences which would be worth exploring. Okay, so thank you.
Questions? Yeah. The question is, usually the mu problem, the usual solutions for the mu problem are involve singlets, and how do you see that in this context?
This really sort of goes under this last question. First of all, there are, you know, various proposals. Some of them do involve, for example, singlets which carry discrete charges, okay, so which transform under discrete symmetries. And I should perhaps be a little careful. When I say low energy, I really sort of mean lower than conventional intermediate scale scenarios. There are all sorts of things which people, including people here, have talked about with various hot scales that are sort of in between. And that might be relevant for generating such a scale, might be relevant, for example, to the mu problem.
Last question.
Did I understand you correctly, Michael, when you said that, for example, the dilaton was fixed at the
Yes.
The question. Oh.
Well,
the question is how the gauge couplings can be weak when the dilaton is stabilized at the cell's dual point.
Okay. Well, this went back to this earlier discussion. The gauge couplings are, of course, at this point, picture is the gauge couplings are some numbers. Okay. They're not in general equal to the dilaton. Right. I mean, if you think already about n equals 2, there are corrections. Right, there are corrections to the gauge coupling functions, which is, you know, what Seiberg and Witten studied, among other things, but which, you know, involve, you know, instantons and so on. Okay, and so the gauge coupling function is some number, if you like, at this point is some number. Okay, which, you know, is whatever it is. Okay, and it could be. So the argument is just that a priori, I don't know that. You know, if assuming there are thousands of these things, for example, I don't know that it isn't occasionally, or the inverse, this coupling isn't occasionally a large number, okay, isn't occasionally unified, and if you think about, for example, then you have to worry about about things like Schiffman-Wahnstein type things, but in some sense it's sort of self-consistent to imagine that those are small. Those corrections are small, so the real effect of couplings are small numbers.
And just a quick follow-up for you. So as far as if you wanted the low energy 2D breaking, for that sector, I guess the gauge coupling would have to be large,
Well, it might need to be larger, for example. You'd like it to be, well, we don't want it to be large at that scale, at that high scale. It still should be a small number. You might not want it to be exactly unified.
Yeah, so I guess there would be a mismatch between the...
You might need a mismatch, absolutely. When I said unified, I was referring to the standard model coupling.
Okay, we have to stop here, so let's thank the speaker again.